A Story Publishing presents Valuation Blueprint. Welcome to Section 1 of our comprehensive audio study guide. In this part, we will walk step by step through every sub-question in the Walmart Cost of Capital block, that is question 2 on your practice exam. Think of this as sitting side by side with a tutor who wants you to understand the intuition, the math in plain language, the professor's preferred nomenclature, and the small traps that cause trouble on your first attempt. Whenever you hear me say, "Now pause the recording," that is your cue to stop, say the formula aloud, or try a quick mental computation before letting the narration continue. Let us set the scene. You have Yahoo Finance data for Walmart, dated 19th February of 2021. The screen shows $138.42 per share, a beta listed as 0.48, a market capitalization of roughly $391.6 billion, and so on. Separately, you have debt and cash figures drawn from the January 31, 2021 balance sheet. The board of directors wants to know Walmart's current weighted average cost of capital, or WACC, and what happens if the firm increases its net debt to 25% of total value. With that backdrop, let us begin. Question 2, subpart A, asks, for the purpose of the WACC calculation, what is Walmart's current capital structure, stated as the percentage of equity and the percentage of net debt? In plain language, we need to figure out of every dollar of Walmart's enterprise value, how many pennies come from shareholders, and how many pennies are financed by creditors once we offset cash. Market value of equity, sometimes called market cap, equals share price multiplied by the number of shares outstanding. The Yahoo screen says $391.6 billion. That is your numerator for equity. Net debt is total interest-bearing debt minus cash or short-term investments. The exam's balance sheet figure for net debt is $51.7 billion. Add equity and net debt, and you get total firm value, roughly $443.3 billion. Divide equity by that total, and you get 88.3%. Divide net debt by that same total, and you get 11.7%. Concisely, Walmart is about 88% equity financed and 12% debt financed once you net cash. You may now pause the recording if you want to repeat those percentages or substitute your own round numbers to see how the fractions work. Moving to subpart B, the board member Michael Seltzer asks for Walmart's long-term WACC at the current target structure. We proceed in three clear sentences. Sentence 1, state the cost of equity using the capital asset pricing model. Speak it out. Cost of equity equals risk-free rate plus equity beta times market risk premium. In our data set, the risk-free rate is 2.15%, the beta is 0.48, and the premium is 5%. Multiply 0.48 by 5%, that is 2.4%. Add 2.4 to the risk-free 2.15, and you get approximately 4.55%. That number is read aloud as 4.5%, that is R sub E. Sentence 2. Identify the cost of debt. The problem says the yield to maturity on AA Walmart bonds is 2.45%, yet the debt beta is assumed to be zero, meaning the systematic risk portion is nil. We can treat that entire 2.45% as the pre-tax cost of debt. Sentence 3. Assemble the WACC. Multiply the equity share of 0.883 by 4.55%. That comes to roughly 4.01%. Multiply the debt share of 0.117 by 2.45%. Because interest is tax deductible, you then multiply by 1 minus the tax rate, that is 75%. The after-tax cost of debt contribution is therefore about 0.21%. Add 4.01 and 0.21, and you reach roughly 4.22%. Spoken answer. Walmart's current weighted average cost of capital is about 4.2%. Now pause the recording and practice saying each step. CAPM for equity, debt cost, tax shield, and the weighted sum. Subpart C asks for Walmart's asset beta, Here, the professor expects you to stress that asset beta is the unlevered beta, the pure business risk stripped of financing effects. Since the debt beta is zero, the asset beta equals equity beta times the equity fraction. That is 0.48 multiplied by 0.883, giving about 0.424. Read that out. Asset beta is roughly 0.42. A common mistake students make is to forget the weighting and just repeat the equity beta. That inflates the business risk measure. Pause now if you need to absorb the idea that asset beta always lies between debt beta and equity beta. We progress to subpart D. The scenario: Nathan Tribble proposes raising net debt to 25% of total value. Kate Fuentes wants to know the new cost of levered equity. The logic is unlever and lever again. First, keep the asset beta constant at 0.424. Set the debt share at 0.25, the equity share at 0.75, and keep debt beta at 0. Solve the equation. Asset beta equals equity beta times equity share. Rearranged, equity beta equals asset beta divided by equity share. 0.424 divided by 0.75 yields roughly 0.565. Next, feed that equity beta back into CAPM. Risk-free 2.15 plus beta, 0.565 times the market premium, 5% gives 2.15 plus 2.83, totaling about 4.98%. Announce it in full. With 25% debt, the cost of equity rises to roughly 5%. Pause now if you wish to repeat the unlever-relever logic aloud. Subpart E asks for the new WACC at 25% debt. Build the sentence. 75% equity times 4.98% equals about 3.74%. 25% debt times 2.45% times 75% tax shield equals about 0.42%. Add them for a total of roughly 4.16%. It is slightly lower than the previous 4.22%, which leads us straight into subpart F. Subpart F, the qualitative explanation, must highlight that WACC decreases because the tax shield on additional low-risk debt outweighs the rise in equity cost. You can say, debt is relatively cheap for Walmart, interest is tax-deductible, and the small extra risk borne by equity holders is not enough to offset that benefit, so the blended cost edges down. Now to subpart G. Meshack Cleary argues a debt beta of 0 is too conservative and proposes 0.1. You first recalculate asset beta. Equity share 0.883 times equity beta, 0.48, plus debt share 0.117 times debt beta 0.1, yielding about 0.436. Then, under the new 25% debt structure, solve for the new equity beta. Asset beta 0.436 minus debt fraction 0.25 times debt beta 0.1 divided by equity fraction 0.75. Work it through aloud. The numerator becomes 0.436 minus 0.025. That is 0.411. Divide by 0.75. Result approximately 0.548. This re-levered equity beta is slightly lower than before, because part of the systematic risk is now borne by the debt holders. Make sure you mention the effect. Assigning a positive debt beta shifts a tiny slice of risk away from shareholders and lowers the new cost of equity relative to treating debt as purely risk-free. Subpart H involves ROIC, return on invested capital, for the trailing 4 quarters. The formula is NOPAT, which is EBIT times 1 minus the tax rate, divided by invested capital, defined here as the book value of debt plus book value of equity minus cash. The exam's quick numbers. EBIT around 23 billion, tax rate 25%, invested capital around 133 billion. 23 times 75% equals roughly 17.25 billion. Divide by 133 and you get about 13%. State it clearly. Walmart earned roughly 13% on invested capital, far exceeding its 4% WACC, indicating strong value creation. Subpart I is conceptual. Which risk measure is more comparable for Walmart and Target, equity beta or asset beta? The answer is asset beta, because asset beta reflects the underlying retail business risk absent leverage differences. Equity betas can diverge simply due to capital structure choices. If you are discussing relative operating risk, always compare asset betas. That completes every sub-question in the Walmart block. Let us quickly recap. First, calculate weights by dividing equity and net debt by total value. Second, use CAPM for cost of equity. Third, weigh equity and after-tax debt to get WACC. Fourth, recognize how increasing leverage changes equity beta and therefore do ACC. Fifth, remember that assigning a positive debt beta reallocates risk. Sixth, compute ROIC over invested capital and compare it to WACC. Seventh, use asset beta to compare peer business risk. Now pause the recording one last time and in your own words summarize each formula. Once you can do that without hesitation, you are in line with the professor's expectations. Welcome to section 2 of our audio study guide, where we tackle two big valuation blocks from the practice exam. First, we will journey through the Beyond Meat discounted cash flow model, question 3, and answer each board member's concern. Then, we will shift to question 4, the Merck multiples scatter plot, to understand how enterprise versus equity metrics drive valuation comparisons. Listen closely, repeat formulas aloud when prompted, and pause the recording whenever you want to think through an example. Let's set the Beyond Meat scene. The spreadsheet you were given says the intrinsic value per share is roughly $90, but the real-world share price is closer to $150. The model assumes a peak return on invested capital, or ROIC, just under 45% in the year 2025, tapering to around 20-plus percent by 2039. Sales are forecast to grow from about $650 million in 2019 to $6 billion 2 decades later. Weighted average cost of capital, WACC, is 6.4%, and because the company is largely equity financed, that 6.4 also represents the cost of equity. With that framework, let us proceed question by question. Subpart A. Board member Alex Sawabini notes the market price is $150, well above the model's $90. The qualitative question, what would need to change in our assumptions to lift the model to match market pricing? The principle is straightforward. Either the projected ROIC must stay higher for longer, or sales growth must accelerate and persist at those elevated levels. Imagine telling a colleague, to get from $90 to $150, we likely need an extra burst of growth, or ROIC, that remains above 20% beyond 2039. Now pause and picture yourself adjusting a spreadsheet slider. Push either the revenue growth curve or the long-run ROIC line upward and watch value climb toward 150. Subpart B, Kirsten Cooper asks, what does a long-term ROIC of 20 imply about competition after 2039? The answer, it implies weak competition or powerful competitive advantages. When ROIC is 3 times the firm's 6.4% cost of capital far into the future, you are assuming economic profits persist. In an efficient, competitive market, ROIC tends to decline toward the cost of capital, so maintaining 20% suggests meaningful barriers to entry. Think strong branding, patents, or exclusive distribution. Subpart C. JP Madaras wonders, if we lower ROIC to a highly competitive level, say, just above WACC, but we increase terminal growth, will value rise? The key concept, growth only adds value when the firm earns excess returns. If ROI falls near WACC, each incremental dollar of reinvestment yields little or no economic profit. So even if you assume faster growth, you are basically compounding zero economic profit, which does not meaningfully increase intrinsic value. Thus, raising the growth rate in the terminal period cannot offset a big drop in ROIC if that ROIC is hovering around the cost of capital. Chris Linosi asks a classic finance question. Given an efficient stock market, what internal rate of return, or IRR, can an investor expect at the current price? And what is the net present value, or NPV, of buying today? The answer is elegantly simple. In an efficient market, IRR on the stock equals the cost of equity, here about 6.4%, and the NPV to the marginal buyer is zero. You buy expecting a fair return, neither you nor the seller captures a free dollar of additional value. Pause now, repeat aloud. In an efficient market, IRR equals cost of equity, NPV equals zero. Subpart E. Tosin Omoli points out that free cash flow for 2020 is negative $96 million, yet tax-adjusted EBIT is positive $34 million. What gives? Free cash flow equals NOPAT minus capital expenditures minus the change in working capital and other long-term investments. A high-growth company can easily be EBIT positive, but free cash flow negative if it is plowing cash into new factories, R&D, or inventory. This does not necessarily signal poor performance. It shows aggressive investment for expansion. Picture Beyond Meat signing new co-manufacturing contracts, building extra production lines, front-loading the cash outflow. Pause if you need to reaffirm. Negative FCF during growth is normal when CapEx and working capital spike. Subpart F. Brian Heslin observes that enterprise value is $5.288 billion, but subtracting net debt actually increases equity value because net debt is negative $245 million. Negative net debt simply means cash exceeds total debt. You are effectively adding cash on top of enterprise operations, therefore equity value can surpass enterprise value. That is not a problem. It tells investors they have more cash cushion than debt obligation. Subpart G. Jing Tu references Shaky Jake's assertion that value creation equals NOPAT minus WACC times invested capital. The model suggests roughly $25 million of value creation in 2020. Put plainly, operating profits after tax exceed the required return on invested capital by that margin, and discounting that future stream plus all subsequent years gives the enterprise value we referenced earlier. We have now completed Beyond Meat's board questions. Quick recap. To justify a 150 share price, you need higher growth or persistently high ROI. 20% long run ROIC implies weak competition. Growth without excess returns adds little value. IRR equals the cost of equity in an efficient market. Negative free cash flow during growth is normal. Negative net debt signals a cash surplus, and annual value creation equals NOPAT minus capital charge. Shift your mindset to the Merck multiples chart you have in front of you. You can picture a red trend line ascending across a scatter of blue dots labeled ABBT, GSK, PFEMRK, LLY, NVS, JNJ, and so on. The x-axis is earnings per share, and the y-axis is share price. Subpart A, Nikki Marin asks whether the multiple over or undervalues Merck relative to its actual market price. In the scatter plot, Merck, marked in red, lies above the trend line, meaning its true share price is higher than what the regressed line predicts. Thus, the earnings multiple understates Merck's price. Said differently, the simple PE-based model undervalues Merck. Subpart B. Mika Owen wonders if we can legitimately use enterprise value divided by net income. The professor's answer is no. Enterprise value belongs with firm-wide cash flow measures like EBITDA or EBIT. Net income is after interest, so it pertains only to equity holders. Mixing enterprise value with net income muddles the signal. Subpart. Fareen Sundarji wants to know whether patents as a value driver calls for enterprise or equity value. Patents benefit all capital providers, not just shareholders, so the correct pairing is enterprise value per patent. Subpart D. Mark Weissenborn notices GlaxoSmithKline or GSK is below the line and wonders if lower risk explains that. Actually, in multiple space, lower risk usually commands a higher multiple, pushing a firm above, not below, the trend line. Therefore, GSK's position is unlikely explained by lower risk alone. Subpart E. Michael Ozuna asks if Eli Lilly sits above the line because it is more profitable. Profit margins influence both price and earnings, often canceling out in the PE ratio. More likely, Lilly trades above the line due to stronger growth expectations or perceived strategic advantages rather than mere profitability. Subpart, Sam Houghton asks whether Bristol-Myers' below-line position could stem from lower growth. Yes, slow growth diminishes the present value of future economic profit for a given earnings level and would naturally place a firm below the multiple trend line. Let's tie a bow on section 2. We walked you through every board question for Beyond Meat: valuation gaps, competition implications, growth value interaction, IRR versus NPV, free cash flow dynamics, negative net debt, and value creation. Then we decoded each scatterplot interpretation point for Merck. The big takeaways are: match enterprise value with firm-wide drivers, equity value with equity drivers, growth and risk, not just profitability, drive multiples, and if a company's long-run ROIC dwarfs its WACC, that signals persistent competitive advantage. Now pause and reflect. Can you verbally summarize why higher ROIC or higher growth pushes the DCF up, or why EV over net income is a mismatch? If you can explain those concepts confidently, you will align with the professor's grading logic. That concludes section 2 of the audio guide. Thank you for choosing Astory Publishing.